You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Lynn Wright, who is the Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence and the head of the Naval Intelligence Activity. In these positions, she supports the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Warfare, the Director of Naval Intelligence, in delivering comprehensive, substantive intelligence to Navy leadership, oversees intelligence activities within the Navy, represents the Navy within the intelligence community, creates naval intelligence policy, and performs policy oversight functions. She's also served in various leadership positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Staff, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, NATO in Afghanistan, theater commands, and combat support agencies. Welcome, Lynn. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Well, thank you very much.
So I like to begin conversations like this with usually it's a former practitioner, but we're very happy to have a current practitioner here to ask you a little bit about career choices. You've served across the intelligence
right.
community, certainly in ONI, Office of Secretary of Defense, ODNI, DIA, a stint where you're working with NSA.
Right.
Did you always want a career in intelligence, or was this an accidental career path that you got into through other means?
It's actually a fairly interesting story. I went to Old Dominion University down in Norfolk, and I was a professional bartender, and I went to school a lot, and I accidentally graduated early. So I was looking at, so what am I going to do now? And so I called a friend who worked for a predecessor organization for the Naval Intelligence Activity. He worked for the Naval Intelligence Command, and I said, hey, you guys hiring? And this is the mid-1980s, the Reagan buildup. And he said, yeah, we are hiring. He says, how good are you at math? And I said, not so much. He says, okay, I've got just the job for you. And so I did it. I did a fairly perfunctory interview. They showed me the salary for GS-5, which then was about $13,000 a year. And I said, this is way more than I'm making as a bartender.
Yeah.
And I said, absolutely. And I really have not looked back since. So
things have changed somewhat as far
yeah.
as how to get into the career.
Yeah.
What is good advice that you could offer for those in college and grad school, or even who are already doing careers within the intelligence community or the military, but not within naval intelligence or you know, specific to like an MI field?
Well, I tell you, it's we need all kinds of people, and so if you're in college or you're in graduate school and you're thinking about, I would like to be into the intelligence community, I would say reach out. There are a lot of organizations, INSA, for example, that has ways of connecting young people up with people who are already in the community. You can go ahead and apply for jobs, apply for the entry-level jobs. Internships are the absolute best way, because the beautiful thing is that you start your clearance early.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not get all the way through the process by the time you start your internship, but generally by the time you've shown what you can do, then you can come back and your clearance will be completed, and then you can, and you're a known quantity, and we'll be happy to bring you on board. Within Naval Intelligence, where the Navy itself is a very technologically, involved force in the United States. However, there is a lot of room for people other than engineers and data scientists and people like that. And you really need a wide variety of people, a wide variety of interest. And quite frankly, when I was doing entry-level hiring at ONI, people with interesting backgrounds interest me.
Right.
Right? People who had odd sort of graduate school degrees and things like that. Because I don't need everybody who thinks like me, right? I don't need engineers that only think one way. I need a variety of engineers. I need a variety of the soft, sciences, the social sciences, political science, history majors, and things
like
that.
We're not insulted when you call us soft.
I know. Soft is good. I'm very soft. Yes. But, what we're looking for are people who think, can put things together, people who like puzzles, and people who can communicate right and who are not afraid of taking a stand. And I think that's really important. You got to be willing to stand up for yourself against a community that can be really tough sometimes. But if you know what's right, then go for it.
People may have the misperception of the military intelligence branches as, well, if I don't want to join the Navy, it doesn't make sense for me. I'll go work for CIA or NSA. But there's an extraordinary amount of civilian employees in ONI.
Correct. There's over 3,000. And we, and quite frankly, the civilians are the core that keeps the whole business going, because we are on target, on mission for our entire careers. The naval officers, the enlisted folks, they come through and they'll do a substantive job, maybe a couple of first tours, substantive job, and then they're pushed into leadership and management positions, right? And so it's always the civilians who keep it going. The military come in and they make it really interesting, though, because they question, why is it organized that way? Or are you really doing stuff that supports the fleet? And folks, it's good to have your things questioned, your ideas questioned from time to time. And that's what the military is they come in, say, hey, this is what we need out in the fleet. You need to reorientate yourself to support the fleet.
Yeah, and I think another major misperception, certainly among the kind of the civilian public, is that the military is rigid and not
an
institution.
No.
I mean, I'm an ex-Army guy, and Army is the slowest moving of all of them, but still...
Because you're massive.
Right, massive and wide change when it works.
Yeah.
But still, the Army is very innovative. I mean, the Marines, of course, they're tiny, they have no money, they're the most, but maybe. But people, this misperception is crazy, because the military is usually way ahead of others in being innovative and thinking outside the box.
Correct. And that's what I've always found, is that when there's new technologies, new techniques... There's always some young soldier or sailor there who does this on weekends, and he says, hey, why don't we do it this way? And they bring it in. And quite frankly, there's a lot of room to maneuver within sort of the bureaucratic structure.
As a historian of this world, looking at ONI, and I've read a good amount about it, being a military or a naval intelligence officer used to be a death knell for a career.
Yes.
Where you'd... People scrambled to get out of it as fast as they could to be a fleet commander,
or
even the submarine force laughed and kind of watched them and said, "Oh, you're an ONI, I'm a sub commander. I'm going to be an admiral before you are."
Right.
That seems to have shifted. I mean, is that another misperception that people should just kind of wipe off their?
Yeah,
their ideas?
I think this division between what we call and what has really grown, between operators and intel guys, right? Where being an operator was everything. But the thing that we've seen is that perhaps back in starting in the 80s, and although I didn't realize it at the time, there were a lot of things going on in the background. But when you're 22 years old, you have no idea what's really going on. Quite frankly, intel drives operations. Okay, and you want to talk about the submarine force, you want to talk about the surface force. It's probably the submariners for the most case. they are most in bed with the intelligence. They do a lot of ISR missions. Mm-hmm. Good submarine captains are also very good intelligence officers. And we saw in the 1980s really the growth of, you know, the absolute leaders of naval intelligence became absolute leaders across the U.S. government. People like Bobby Ray Inman, mm-hmm. the first four-star Intel Admiral, McConnell, Admiral Studeman, the Elder, as we call him. His son just picked up his first star. His son is an outstanding intelligence officer as well. Just there is a wide range of opportunities for intelligence officers, and the thought that because you're an intelligence or you're a cryptologist, you're a lesser being is not the case. And I would say that even the last 16 years, that's become even more of the case.
Right.
If you look at soft operations, insurgency operations, they are built around having a really good intelligence picture. And quite frankly, if you look at the chain of events from the point where you decide you need to do something about a particular situation and the point where the door is kicked in and the action is taken, about 95% of that is about intel operations. It's about maneuvering the collection and doing the analysis and putting the operator in the place where he can safely execute his mission. And I think no one who has been in the desert misunderstands sort of the relationship between intelligence and operations.
Is it fair to say that intelligence is still a specific discipline, but that the belief in the worth of intelligence has dissipated into the ranks, into the surface fleet? I mean, I'm thinking of Mike Mullen, you know,
right.
When he was chairman of the JCS, of really seeming to he's not an intel guy, but you could see that he truly
understood it. Yeah.
Is that happening across the board, do you think?
Yeah, I think it really is. And I had the pleasure of working for Admiral Mullen when he was the chairman. I was on the joint staff at the time. Good naval officers understand the role of intelligence, right? And it is a good thing when your J3 or your N3 answers the intel question before you do, right? Because that means he's been listening.
Mm-hmm.
He understands the problem well enough to answer it intelligently. And I'm not challenged by that at all. You know, some people get upset and they say, well, he shouldn't be talking about that because he's an operator and you're the intel, you know, and all the rest. I say, no. It means that I've won, so
right.
to speak, right? I've co-opted the operational side to understand the intelligence picture because it isn't about my ego. It's about saving lives and ensuring success for the naval forces. And that's what we're about.
Yeah, I mean, mission creep used to be the term, and it just doesn't seem to apply as much anymore, especially if you can get people thinking about the intelligence picture independently of the intelligence branch types.
Yeah, I think the first real introduction I had to this is after the fall of the Berlin Wall back in 89, mm-hmm. right? I used to be the world's best Soviet submarine analyst. I'm just telling you right now. But then the Russians went away, and I didn't have any. So what am I going to do? So I went down to Key West and did counter drug work for a couple of years, and then I came back to Washington and did it up here. But it was actually a surface warfare officer, Admiral Gee, who was the commander of Joint Task Force 4, who really had the most mature understanding of that I've seen in a surface warfare officer of the role of intelligence. And he said, the reality is I don't have enough ships. I need to create operations to create intelligence. And he maneuvered the forces that he had assigned to him to create, you know, intelligence opportunities. And this was something that I later saw when we were doing counterinsurgency work, is initially it's all big iron and we're going to go kick in doors and we're going to do all this stuff. And then you discover, well, what then?
Right.
Right? And then it's about understanding the environment, understanding the people in the environment. It's about understanding the networks. And the operators need to understand that. And they start conducting operations to generate that intelligence. So I think that's a win for everybody.
Yeah, it becomes like a leapfrog effect where the operations lead to intelligence that leads to operations that leads to intelligence that leads to operations.
Yeah, and that was the machine that McChrystal and Flynn created in Balad, was this realization that they were never going to get the cycle rate up high enough to take out the bad guys until they bought into that,
mm-hmm.
right? And really McChrystal and Flynn were just absolutely great at generating the machine. And first you need to realize you need to let go. You know, need to let go of your preconceptions about who does what and why do we do things. And after you do that, it's just absolutely fantastic. It really is.
Let me ask you about the transformation of the role of women within intelligence and the double whammy within military intelligence. Again, because this, I assume, has changed since you joined,
right?
The transformation. I mean, obviously within the military, there's every service branch has jobs available across the board for women now. And it's more of a question of, and I asked this also to the former G2 Mary Legere, who's a three-star general, because
she's super at that.
She's great at that. But I want to ask you as well, this is kind of how you've seen the opportunities for women out there changing within not only intelligence, but also within the military branches.
I think with intelligence, the women within intelligence, when I came in 1985, probably about half the people I hung out with at ONI were female naval intelligence officers. And they were, at the time, great intelligence officers limited to just serving with P-3 squadrons. So, and I love P-3 squadrons because, you know, they're extremely helpful.
Well, you already mentioned that you were the world's leading expert on Soviet subs, so of course you love P-3.
Yeah, I loved them. But the interesting thing is, and they really kicked ass. They did really well. And I think that because of the quality of their work, the importance of the area that they were working in, when the doors opened where you can start sending female officers afloat, it wasn't a hard thing, right? It was a little bit difficult in the 90s, I understand from my friends, but I tell you what, their performance made the difference, right? Mm-hmm. Now, but intelligence people are sort of off in our own little world, right? We weren't trying to command submarines. We weren't driving ships and things like that. And so in my mind, the intelligence community has always been a little bit more advanced than the military as a whole. And that's been advantageous to the military women, I think, because they've been able to grow up in a group of or a community that was like, you know, we really don't care, you know, about gender or whatever.
Right.
What we care about is how smart you are and how well you communicate. And so we've just built on that. And I think that you look at a lot of the great intelligence officers that have come up. Mary Legere is a tremendous example. You know, she's known everything there is to know about the Korea Theater. She did terrifically in Iraq when she was the J2 there. There are women across the board who are leaders in the community right now, and a lot of female leaders that came out of Naval Intelligence. Melissa Drisco, who I was on watch with back in 1985 and 86, is now the deputy director at DIA, and I just can go on with other examples. You just look around and you say, yeah, the leadership in the intelligence community and across the services, my own boss, Jan Tai. The director of Naval Intelligence right now, you know, and it's she's the first female director of Naval Intelligence, and it's like, it's not a big deal.
Right.
You know, it's just not a big deal. It's just,
yeah, very rarely is it emphasized.
It's not just emphasized. Yeah. It's just not something that you do.
Right.
The intelligence community and the services have always had maybe a little bit different view on the whole gender question than the operational forces and things like that. So,
I'm going to ask you an admittedly obnoxiously broad question.
Okay.
That you can decide to narrow down how you want to. So, over your career, how has naval intelligence, in a broad sense, evolved? How has your job? I know your job itself, title wise, is different. But how has the job of a naval intelligence officer or a naval intelligence civilian changed in can't just say the Cold War ended, but
yes.
In a broader sense,
yes.
Since you began to now.
Yeah, I would say the essential skill sets of a naval intelligence officer remains the same. And whether it was in a technical field, understanding foreign technical capabilities and understanding them at an engineering level of detail, or the thing that naval intelligence is different than the other MI services is the operational intelligence aspect, right? What happened at the Battle of Midway and Pearl Harbor and the whole campaign across the South Pacific is still very relevant to what we do mm-hmm. today. And those things have remained consistent. And the skill set of a naval intelligence officer, whether civilian, enlisted, or officer, is actually, and that op-intel aspect of it, the operational intelligence aspect of it, is something that I'm proud to say that naval intelligence has excelled in, right? If you look at who ran intelligence fusion centers in Iraq, Afghanistan, Horn of Africa, invariably you'll find a naval intelligence officer. Why? Because they're really good at putting together the operational picture. Mm-hmm. Whether they knew anything about, the district, Maywan district in Kandahar, you know. So, you know, give them 10 minutes and they'll figure it out, right? And so those skill sets have remained consistent. What has been added on to what we've had to do today is that there are other skills that we need to bring into what are traditional skill sets, right? The understanding of the electromagnetic warfare, mm-hmm. which is highly complex. And that brings back, with the near-peer competitors, there's a lot more things we need to take on board. And it's a little bit more difficult today. But we're getting really good at it. And I'm pretty proud of it. So
we'll break it down a little bit as sure. we move forward. But let me ask you the question. You mentioned fusion centers, and that kind of a good segue to my next question.
Yeah.
What about naval intelligence place among the other IC agencies? Kind of now, you know, in the last 10 years, there's been this kind of this nominal bringing together
right.
of the agencies yeah. to become the quote-unquote capital I, capital C intelligence community.
Right.
Has that impacted the way the job works? Certainly at the high levels like yours, it impacted the way your job worked.
Right. I think it's... So let's talk about naval intelligence place in the intelligence mm-hmm. community. So we're actually the oldest intelligence organization in the U.S. government. We started in 1882. And so we like to build on that. We have a very highly competent workforce. We have great officers and enlisted. Our advantage is that we have those great people and we're inside the Washington area. And so when you talk to the other service intel centers, you know, the advantage of being within Washington and being able to, on a daily basis, interact with CIA folks mm-hmm. and interact with NSA... my opportunities to go work up at NSA or CIA was derived out of the fact that location is everything.
Right.
Right. I think that we, for our area, we do a really good job. We are not NSA and we're not DIA, but I think that among the service intel centers, I'm really proud of where we're at. I think all the service intel centers do better than a lot of people realize.
Right.
Our customer is the U.S. Navy, and making sure that the U.S. Navy gets what they need to build the next Navy. We have to do assessments. We're in the process of building a new SSBN force, right, the Columbia SSBN. Columbia is going to, the first one won't pop out until the late 2020s, and it'll be operation for 40 years after that.
Right.
So... imagine having to do threat intelligence for the next 60 years.
Because it's kind of failed a little bit before, I think, with the Seawolf class, which was going to revolutionize everything. And the Cold War ended.
The Cold War ended, right? And so that's actually really interesting. So you try to do everything at once. The Seawolf was a heck of a submarine, right? But it was like the most advanced submarine in the history of the universe, you know? And it was built on the premise that the Soviets would continue on their building plan and things of that nature. And so the threat collapsed underneath them. And then you can't really, with a peace dividend, you can't really continue to build Seawolf and all the rest of that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. But you take those lessons and you roll them into Virginia, you roll them into Columbia. And guess what? You know, Putin, when he came back into the presidency back in the early 2000s, the Russian submarine force was one of the areas. He made some really great strategic choices about where he made his investments. And one of those areas was the Russian Navy. They spent the 90s getting rid of a lot of old crap that they had hanging around since the 1950s.
And all that, like, Kilo 2s sailing around anymore. And,
I mean, well, you know, getting... I mean, they... When I left the business in the submarine business in 92, I mean, they still had Novembers and Echoes, right. And I mean, first generation submarines. That would be like us having Nautilus still in operation. And he made a really deliberate choice to get rid of the older class of submarines to make strategic investments. And he is benefiting from those strategic investments today. And so it's incumbent upon us in Naval Intelligence to make sure that we were tracking it all the way along. We understand the capabilities of Severodvinsk and Dolgoruki, and then we're able to incorporate that into threat assessments for Columbia.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Let me ask you about multinational cooperation. This is not a throwaway question about how the Five Eyes work. I'm interested to see that some of those what we considered enemies or at least adversaries are now relatively close allies. And Vietnam is the one that really pops into my head. I mean,
I'm fascinated by Vietnam.
Yeah, it's the idea of the South China Sea and some of these countries coming together because China scares the hell out of everybody.
Yeah.
That, you know, a generation ago or less were arch enemies or people we certainly wouldn't talk to, and now we're having joint operations with them. It just seems fascinating to me. How much within your job, within, you know, the ONI, are you dealing with your counterparts of foreign navies?
I do so quite frequently. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is something that somebody once said, and I can't remember the name of the figure who said it, is, nations don't have permanent allies, they have permanent interest, right? And it's important to stay focused on that. And it's important in the intelligence community or intelligence business to think about the future, right? So China is a really difficult problem, but it's only a difficult problem if you think about it in terms of just China-US.
Right.
Right? So you really need to think about what are the traditional strengths of the United States, which is we have true friends and allies and partners. And as long as we continue to exhibit leadership in that area, people want to work with us. I see that around the world when I travel. I think that if we provide people an opportunity and we're sort of sensitive to how they want to do things, I think that we can create a lot of opportunities for ourselves. And you never want it to be 1v1. You don't want it to be U.S.-China.
Right.
You want it to be, you know, China versus everybody.
Right.
Right?
Well, and China is finding ways to close the gap, and they're doing it in innovative ways. They're not building a fleet of aircraft carriers.
No.
You know, they're trying
to find...
As much
as I would like them to do,
right,
so.
Right, yeah. I mean, they're, you know, the wonky term, you know, A2AD, they're looking at area, you know, area, anti-access area denial operations, building anti-ship missiles and stuff. And you talk about thinking and planning out decades ahead.
Right.
you know, I think back to those that talked about how the battleship was going to be the king of the ocean in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
We say the same thing now about the
aircraft
big,
carriers.
Like the Nimitz class just rolled off. It's the size of a,
it's
a couple city blocks and others. And you know, China's not trying to match us one for one. They're trying to look at different and innovative ways of doing it. And I'm not trying to plug the book Ghost Fleet if you've read it. If not,
I have. I love it. I think it's a great book.
It's, you know, the Red Storm Rising, I guess, of the 21st century. But network systems bring the good with the bad.
Right.
You know, the idea of we are getting to the point where we're very reliant on technology that could kind of come back to bite us in the end.
Right.
Where do you see this going? I mean, without getting to this, could be a 5-hour conversation but in a general sense. You know, I mean, how much, I'm certainly you're paying attention to what the Chinese are up to, but that seems like it'd be very hard to do long-term planning with the kind of evolution of how fast this is going.
I think this gets into a couple of your previous questions, you know, the skill sets of a naval intelligence officer and bringing in other sort of domain knowledge areas. And one of those domain knowledge areas is, you know, what is the rise of networks and AI and machine learning mean to your skill set, right? I think I was fascinated by, I almost went out and bought it the day that it was available because I'm a real fan of Peter Singer. I'd read some of his previous books. And I thought it was a very coherent way of how he told the story, which is a very realistic way in which it could happen. He pushed some things because he wanted to create certain situations, but I mean, that all works.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. I think that it's important to be very knowledgeable in a variety of domains of knowledge, to be flexible and innovative in how people put things together, right? And to recognize, and don't be roped into, well, A to AD equals this, and the range ring is an iron bubble that goes out. And the CNO is actually, he's pretty specific on this, in that there has always been A to AD. Right? The range ring is not an iron bubble. There are things that we can do to get in and out as we need, but you need to be flexible in how you think about things, right? You need to do things in innovative ways. You need to be prepared to do things in ways that don't necessarily make you comfortable. I'll tell you, my big concern is sort of the risk calculation.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at a near-peer crisis going into a war-type situation, your risk calculation has to be radically different than where our risk calculation has been over the last 16, 15 years, right? And so you need to be prepared to do some things that make you really uncomfortable. And I think that you need to be innovative in how you put together things. You need to be able to adopt commercial items and commercial capabilities into your capabilities, and you need to be able to go old school at a drop of a hat.
Right.
Right? You need to be able to say, okay, satellites are gone. Where is that teletype operator, right?
Or celestial navigation.
Where is the celestial navigation, right? And I had a friend of mine who said, you need to be able to do the basics brilliantly, right? And so you need to do well at the basics of your craft. And whether that craft is intelligence, whether that craft is ASW or anti-ship operations, very agile logistics. Logistics are everything.
Right.
Has
that atrophied over the last 15 years because of the focus on counterterrorism and maybe that's an unfair question. Did it have the opportunity to atrophy and there were people fighting back against it?
Yeah.
I don't know how you want to answer that, but it's...
I think you need to understand the nation had a priority on activities in CENTCOM AOR. It's a highly permissive environment. It is primarily a ground force. It took up a lot of money, and naval forces are very expensive. And they need to be refreshed at a set rate because they tend to, when they become obsolete, almost totally, right? And so the nation needs to decide whether they want to invest in a naval force that can be competitive in a near-peer competition. And they need to understand that it will not be overwhelming dominance. It'll be a tough fight.
And I think we've become accustomed to being so much better than everybody else,
right,
that we haven't seen a slug match since 1945, probably. I mean, Vietnam just didn't... It was asymmetrical, all right? It was asymmetrical,
and yeah, there's a whole discussion about that, but and the Navy is thinking seriously about this. I think people like Admiral Harris and Scott Swift out in Hawaii are thinking some really terrible, dark thoughts.
Well, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. You probably do, but you sink one American aircraft carrier with all hands, that's basically the amount of people that died on 9/11.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is this is something that I think about a lot.
Yeah.
Right? Potentially one day of combat in the Western Pacific, we can lose as many sailors as we've lost in 16 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's going to be and that's something that, you know, you need to make sure that the American people understand, okay? And this drives one of the CNO's real issues, is making sure that the American sailor is a tough sailor and understands that it's going to be a tough fight. And we need to just make sure that people understand. And I think if the American people understood, if you know, what kind of issues that we're dealing with, I'm a firm believer that not fighting is a good answer if you can achieve your national goals in other ways. And so smart national planning is really, really critical.
One thing that fascinates me and is that most maps of the world for the past, let's say, millennia have been pretty much the same. But there's a pretty radical transformation taking place up north.
Yes.
The Arctic Ocean is actually becoming a pretty significant ocean.
It really is.
And the passability of it it has some real diplomatic and geopolitical, you know, implications in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
It really does.
And, you know, the Army has really been the ones, I guess, thinking a whole lot about Russia as a potential adversary, dealing with the little green men and hybrid warfare, you know, realities on the ground, whether it's in Crimea or Ukraine. But you have to think about how the opening of the Arctic and how hybrid warfare can actually be expanded to naval assets.
Right.
Is that something that, you know, while it may not be priority number one, is on that list somewhere, thinking about the future potential issues about not only the Arctic, but dealing with a resurgent Russia? I mean, you talked about it a little bit. But
yeah, I think that... And it's actually on the front of my mind, because the Secretary of the Navy was just recently in Iceland for a series of Arctic meetings with the Arctic Council and things like that. So we did the prep with him to talk about, you know, what's real and what's not real up there. The Arctic is a really interesting thing, is that it's what the Russians are doing up there is essentially reinvesting in a lot of facilities that they had back during the Cold War that they had closed up due to lack of funds and et cetera. The issue of more ice-free areas for longer amounts of time, really important. And I think that if the price of oil gets to a certain point, then the resource game up in the Arctic becomes viable. Because you need a sort of a higher price of oil to make that really economically viable. And so I think it's a really interesting situation up there. It's really important that we work with our allies and work with all the partners and just make sure we understand what everybody's doing.
And the good news is all the other countries that abut the Arctic are our allies.
Correct.
You know, you talked about it's not just one-on-one. It's everybody versus the bad guy. And in this case, it's...
Yeah, and there's a venue with the Arctic, various Arctic councils to have, you know, good... There's a set of rules on how we have conversations about it. I think there's only one or two areas where there's boundary disputes ongoing, and then there was a there's a formal process to resolve those. And that's the important thing, is that having a formal process where you can sort of take a look at the science related to the claim, and you can adjudicate the claim, and everybody accepts that's what the adjudication is. And so there's a structure and a process in place there. I think the Arctic's really important. I think that we should continue to support the Coast Guard in terms. I think there was a in the most recent budget year, there was a planning for more icebreakers was laid in. So, I mean, it's something that we're going to have to get back into, I think.
The ONI has production authority for worldwide scientific and technical developments. And that's, you're kind of
for
the,
naval.
For naval, right? Yeah. So you're focused on, you know, the understanding technological developments when it comes to that. In a general sense, how do we keep abreast of that? Because my background is S&T as well, and it's not necessarily just understanding what is being built or being discovered naturally, but also the co-option of our technology or of Western technology. I think of North Korea using the internet against us.
Right,
where they all of a sudden have capabilities they never could have developed in-house.
Right.
But they're taking, you know, on the Army side, this would be like ISIS with M1 tanks.
Right.
So how do you double that? How do you keep abreast of what's happening naturally? And you can use North Korea as a good example of this, right? Whether they're, you know, we're trying to figure out, are they developing solid fuel for their rockets? Or what are they grabbing from China or even the West to potentially be able to use against us as well?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting problem, is that is as technology becomes more diffuse, the opportunity to co-opt commercial technology or even academic kind of things that are still in the academic world and then bring it into your war fight is really kind of interesting right now. You know, in the past it was, you know, decades to sort of watch these changes happen. And just the growth on incorporation of new technology has gone exponential. So if you want an intelligence force that's looking at S&T issues, they need to be cognizant of the developments in the commercial world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this gets back to your first question about who are we hiring and things like that. That's why it's very important to keep refreshing your sort of your engineering, your technology space. So they're very familiar with, you know, sort of developmental trends in the academic world. They bring that into ONI, and they say, hey, I remember my professor was talking about this, and let's look at that.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful thing is that people write a ton of stuff in open source, you know?
Right.
And you can take that and really think about it. And this gets into the innovation of how you think. This is why we want innovative thinkers within naval intelligence.
Let me ask you also about support for irregular warfare operations.
Right.
Because I think that's something that you've been very busy doing, I assume, over the last decade and a half or so.
Yes.
From 2009 to 2011, you were the deputy director of the Afghan-Pakistan Task Force. And I think of there was a relatively high-profile special operations irregular warfare raid during that time period in Abbottabad, Pakistan.
Which I knew nothing about.
Okay, that was my question, actually. I wondered how much that was.
No, this is... Yeah. This is
because you're the J-2. You were part of the J-2.
I was in the J-2 in the AFPAC Task Force. And that was a very close hold operation.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, good on them.
Yeah.
Right? They brought in the people that they needed to bring in. They executed it well. And I am extremely proud of what the IC did, what the CIA folks did, what NGA did. Extremely proud of what happened there, right?
Yeah.
I have a personal interest. We lost 7 naval intelligence people on 9/11. Okay? We also lost a Navy reservist who was in the ONI reserve unit. It was a personal thing to us. And so I was quite proud to see that we were able to pull that off and do it. So,
and that seems to really highlight the close-knit cooperation between the different IC agencies. I mean, in bringing in kind of the special operations forces. I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of the public doesn't understand that I'm trying to hammer in the head is that there used to be a bit of a solid line of demarcation between the militarization of kicking down doors and doing things, and then the intelligence community.
Right.
And it doesn't exist anymore.
No.
I mean, you have CIA officers at Tora Bora going after Bin Laden, and then you have think of Operation Red Wing, where you've got SEALs going in doing reconnaissance and intelligence gathering missions and not going to kill somebody, and it just doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
I mean, is that something that is a 9/11 symptom, or is it something that you saw starting a little bit before that?
I would say that it was probably something that we had seen, but it was at a very low rate and a very small percentage of the force.
Mm-hmm.
Which you saw after 9/11 was, you know, the wholesale involvement of white and blacks off and in those kind of operations and sort of the intelligence preparation of the battlefield. Mm-hmm. You know, it's best to be in there quietly, collect the intelligence, pull it out, and then go in and be very specific about what you want to do. And so I think it is a fine art what's going on in the soft community.
Well, you think the dissemination of knowing how to do intelligence
right.
is even being pushed. I mean, I remember I'm an Army vet of the 90s, so I think of the Green Berets, the SF, capital S, capital F guys, were the thinkers.
Yeah.
Of the soft community, right? They went in and taught and spoke all these languages.
Yeah.
But the joke was, if you wanted to take an air base, you dropped in Rangers. If you wanted to blow something up, you sent in the SEALs.
Right.
You know, Marine Force Recon, I guess, are the Raiders now.
Yeah.
You want to, you know, take an island, you sent them in. Now everyone needs to be a lot more cerebral than they were before, because there's a lot of thinking going on in the soft community.
You have to do a lot of thinking. I mean, some of the most brilliant officers and men that I have worked with, and women, there have been some women that I've worked with have been Green Berets. They have been SEALs, and they're extremely thoughtful. They're capable of great violence, but they're a successful day for them is achieving the ends without violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a terrific thing. I just really admire them greatly, because they are doing really great work. I think it's interesting. Recently, it looks like the CIA dumped the rest of, or a lot of the
Bin Laden files.
Laden files, right? And so people are pouring through those and stuff like that. But think about that, right? So you had a SEAL team dropped in there. Their helicopter is on fire. Mm. They're like 30 seconds away from disaster. But they're taking the time to fill duffel bags full of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, and that didn't happen by accident.
Well, and I think that's, you know, when we have separation from the generation that lived through 9/11 and historians are looking back at it, they'll probably say the real success of that raid may have not been killing Osama bin Laden. Yeah. It was all the intel
that
was scooped up from his house.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things. When I was in Afghanistan, I ran the DIA operations in Afghanistan, and we provided a lot of the sensitive site exploitation forces. And you know, that's a very, you have a limited amount of time on site to collect all the material. There is SOP involved in doing that. And we've developed that to a very high science. And I think that no matter what kind of combat operations you're thinking about in the future, everybody who's been doing this knows that, hey, if I don't walk out of there with a duffel bag full of thumb drives and hard drives and things like that, then I have failed in the mission.
Well, let me ask you about support for these operations and all sorts of operations, because I want to ask you about dissemination of intelligence, because one thing I find interesting about intelligence in the military versus the civilian agencies is that the consumer of intelligence is not necessarily a top-level policymaker like the president. And in some cases, consumer intelligence is the warfighter on the ground or the sea or the destroyer captain or the butter bar ensign or an E-5 SEAL team member. How does this dynamic shape what you do? I mean, in essence, this is a question about intelligence flowing downward versus upward.
I think flowing downward is, in many cases, and I'm biased because I've been in that, flowing downward is more satisfying because you have a more direct impact on the safety of your crew, of your shipmates, right? It's about making sure the submariner is safe, that he's able to carry out his operations in a good way. I think it's good to keep the National Command Authority informed. I know that CIA especially has honed that to a high craft. But quite frankly, sometimes policymakers don't really take a lot of action on the intelligence, because if it's getting up to their level, there's some hard questions
right.
there, right? But if I can make the difference in a shipmate's life, then I can do that. Then I'd rather do that.
Let me wrap up with this question, because I think this is a key question, certainly for our audience. And how do we make sure that we're always training, teaching the next group of intelligence officers? Really, how do we make sure we create the next you?
No. That's not possible. There's not that many bartenders out there.
Well, let me kind of sub-question this a little bit. I mean, the job of intelligence across the board requires constant learning and evolving. And in the military side, you know, professional military education courses can't hope to keep up with changes. And even on-the-job training is insufficient in most cases to do this. So what do we make sure that the officers and civilians at ONI can continue to grow and evolve? Like, what's in place? Like, how do we keep the process going?
I think it's important that we tell our stories, right? The older folks, the senior folks, they tell their stories. You have to mentor people. You need to tell them it's okay to stop being a naval architect. It's time for you to go do this budget job so you can understand how things come together, right? You do that through, you know, formal programs, informal programs. For officers, you make sure officer and enlisted, you make sure they have a good variety of tours that they can learn these things. If you selected the right people at the front end and that they're interested in expanding their horizons, you just keep them interested and you keep moving them around. You allow them to be experts in their field, but at a certain point you need to move them around so you can expand them and understand. I think you have to have a natural curiosity, and so we tend to attract the naturally curious. And so you just have to facilitate that. You need to encourage that. You need to sometimes get the middle management out of the way. You know, middle management has a role, right? They have to get the job done. And if you take their analysts and you say, hey, this person needs to go do a joint duty assignment, it's problematic for them.
Right.
Because they have the 10-meter target. We got to be, the leaders of the intelligence community have to be worried about the 1,000-meter target. And it's about developing the next generation. You need to support the analysts. You need to do everything you can to make sure they're the best. Because quite frankly, the quality of the individuals that we're hiring today and we've hired over the last, really the 9/11 generation is unbelievably talented. You cannot imagine how wonderful these young people are. And they're devoted to their craft. They're extraordinarily knowledgeable. They're great people. And they're just fun to hang out with, and that's you just got to take care of them.
I run into a lot of late 20s, early 30s former intelligence officers.
Right.
How do you avoid burnout? Is it important to tell people it's okay to fail? Is it important to tell people that, you know, you're doing an incredibly interesting job, but it's incredibly difficult at the same time, and you're never going to be perfect?
It can be quite draining. So when I was in the AFPAC task force, the reality of my job was filling DIA positions in Afghanistan. And so it was getting human guys in theater. It was getting sensitive site exploitation guys, lab guys, analysts, collectors, collection managers into theater. And it was, and I had civilians who were in their, you know, mid-20s who had already deployed 4 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. And it would be 6 months on, 8 months off, 12 months off, 6 months on. And I had to ask some people to go back who, you know, because the demand was so great during that part of the surge within Afghanistan, that it was really hard. And so, and I would have kids come back and say, I just can't do it. I said, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You have done your nation a great service. Go do something interesting, and maybe 5 or 10 years, if you still want to do this, it'll be here for you. You know, I can't ask any more than that. And I think that's what happened, is that you've met a lot of young folks who did a lot of great things in their 20s, and they're just totally burnt out. The American people need to understand that there were a lot of civilians and military guys who went back, especially on intelligence side, because we were, you know, some of us had one-for-one dwell times and things like
right.
that. They've done a great service for this country. And they went there when a lot of people wouldn't. And so I'm proud to have served with them. And if they want to go, I have one of my analysts is now a editor at History Magazine or American History Magazine. He's a great guy, and he's very proud of his service. But now he's doing something different, mm-hmm. and that's okay.
Well, Lynn Wright is the Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence and the head of the Naval Intelligence Activity. Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today
sure.
at SpyCast.
No problem.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.